So I mentioned in an offhand manner, and I forget which mass it was, so if it wasn't this one, then there it is. But I mentioned in an offhand manner that the Gospels, the evangelist only writes a sentence if he really wants you to know the meaning of the content. Because paper is expensive in the first century AD, so you're not going to write extraneous sentences. You're going to make a point, and you're going to want to say it. Now, it's really funny, because having said that last week, Jesus spends 40 days in the wilderness fasting, and then the evangelist says, and he was hungry. I think if there's anything that is abundantly clear after 40 days, it's that he is hungry. But this story is meant to solidify in the mind of the disciple one in the end, really important principles that the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. Therefore, everything human God has experienced. There is no human pain that there's never existed a human pain that Jesus does not know in his own body. And so, one of the easiest temptations that Christians have always fallen under is to think that Jesus' humanity is some kind of mirage, as if he was some kind of avatar of Krishna in the East, or avatar from James Cameron from Avatar. That God becomes man, and that it is definitive, and that it is permanent, which means that God suffers hunger. He knows exactly what it means to feel his stomach eating itself, to go through the pain of desiring to eat. And then he also knows how to be tempted. He knows what that's like. And immediately, here is a consolation for each and every single one of us. Just because you're tempted doesn't mean you sinned. I'll say this again, and I do it in these little limericks to the beating, so that you remember this, so that in a really bad moment you can remember, oh wait, I'm just tempted, I didn't do anything yet. Just because I'm tempted doesn't mean I sinned. So you may be looking at chocolate after giving it up for Lent, and you saying, boy, I want chocolate. There's nothing wrong with that. If there's a person that says, I don't like chocolate, I'm more concerned about them. We have to know how the balance works. So being tempted doesn't mean you're sinning. Being tempted means, I might have to make a calculated retreat right now. This person said something that ticked me off so much, I want to hurt that person. What's the smart thing to do? Walk away. Temptation is not a sin, because God himself suffered it, which also means that he knows how to endure it. And we're given three specific temptations, which in the end actually are pretty much a sum total of all temptations. And this is another a really important passage for another very important reason. There are a lot of critiques given of the Christian gospel over the last few centuries and for the last few decades. And what I have found, after actually having studied the periods and looking through it, what I found is that the Christians that committed the atrocities gave in to one of these three. It was not necessarily Christianity that did these things. They were not quite Christian enough so as to not see the temptations. Now, I do not mean to say this to beat people over the head. Because the whole point of today's gospel, the whole point of today's story, is to realize that only one has ever been able to stare the devil down the face and be able to reject him. And why is that? Well, this might sound slightly contrived and not necessarily wise, but so who cares? Have you ever noticed that in comic books there's way more villains than heroes? I'm just putting that out there. Have you ever noticed that? Now, I'm not just saying this because, you know, say Spider-Man puts the Green Goblin in prison, and then, of course, now you need another antagonist to make the story move along. But it's something more than that. It's something far more profound than that. Because, you know, Spider-Man's even motto is, with great power comes great responsibility. And if you ever listen to the villains in these stories, everything from their perspective is entirely justifiable. They bullied me in school, so now I'm going to kill them all. I suffered a little bit, so now the entire world has to suffer. I'm in a little pain right now, so everyone must be in pain. I feel insecure and unloved. I will tear down the world so that everyone might know that I'm the most beautiful. Sounds nasty, but that's actually the actual history of the world. So let's just plug through these temptations, shall we? First of all, if you are the Son of God, man, is that a line right there? If you are the Son of God, therefore prove it to me. Now, for any person who wants to defend the Christian faith, this is an incredibly goading attack. Because if somebody goes, if this is true, and then one of the things that we can easily get suckered into is we think that the truth of God is based on whether or not we win the argument. Can get so easily suckered into things like this. If you are the Son of God, well, I'll prove it to you, just give me a challenge, and you've already lost. The proof of the gospel, the proof of Jesus Christ, is not simply in the words that he says or even the deeds that he does, but it's primarily in his resurrection. And so all of these different things that the devil will tempt him with as the story progresses, even if he were to succeed, are still inadequate. There is a parable where even this is the story of Lazarus and the rich man, where Jesus even says, if a man were even to rise from the dead, if somebody is obstinately refusing to believe in God, that won't do it for them. But sometimes we can get tempted into thinking that grand works will somehow prove God. God does not need us to prove himself. What needs to happen is the heart needs to be softened so as to see where he's at. And if we immediately get suckered into this one, then no matter what we say, the person has already beat you. But if you are the Son of God, take these stones and make them into bread. Now, this can sound like just cheap magician work. And in one level, Jesus even does do a miracle of food producing. But it's the wrong time, one. And two, something a little bit more dangerous. How many of us, when we always ask ourselves, if God exists, how come there are so many people that are hungry? That's exactly what the devil is saying. If God is God, why are these people suffering? If God is God, why are you hungry? If God is God, why must you suffer like this? And boy, when you've been not eating for 40 days, that sounds pretty logical. That sounds pretty reasonable. Because really, think about those moments when you either did lose the faith, or you were afraid you would have, or your myriads or friends of family, whatever, that have left the faith. It is usually not rational. It comes from a moment of desperation and fear. The so-called rationalism happens afterwards to explain it away as some kind of justification, as some kind of way of explaining the pain that we're undergoing. And Jesus' answer is beautiful on two levels. One, because he speaks the truth, but two, he also speaks it as the truth as someone who's undergoing it. I eat rather well, as some of you might have noticed by the fact that my chasuble sticks out from time to time. So if I'm going to go to the poor and say, grin and bear it as you're starving, I'm kind of a jerk. And we in the West should often be very, very reluctant to start moralizing countries that are actually going through real starvation, real pain, real difficulties. And so sometimes silence is the best option. But the whole point of the incarnation is that Jesus chooses to suffer everything that we suffer so as to be our companion. And so he is able to put the words in his own mouth out of his mouth, that are the true consolation for all those of us who know what it's like to suffer the fear of hunger. That even if I were to have a full belly, I'll still have an empty heart. And very often when I have an empty heart, I also have an empty brain. That once I do not feed my heart, then my body goes out of whack, and then this just starts, well, actually, that's enough. I don't have to explain it anymore. You start going crazy. Because when the heart is no longer settled, then you see people thinking incredibly irrationally. People think irrationally when they're hungry. People think irrationally when they're hungry for love and companionship. And all of those are deep and dangerous temptations to true fidelity. The second one. The devil led him up and showed him in an instant all the kingdoms of the world. So he almost gives him a vision. And he says, if you will but worship me, because these things are mine, by the way, this is his world. If you worship me, then I will give you authority. The first one is for the comfort of food. The other one's for the comfort of power. Using another cheap, well, that's actually not cheap, it's brilliant, illustration is Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. Not many can stand in the presence of that ring and then not succumb to the desire for power. That I have met so few people in my life that have been able to preface, I'm seeking power, but I'm going to do good things with it. The best leaders always run away from authority like the plague because they know how much it destroys the soul. That weakness is truly where human power lives and operates. It's also what makes us more able to listen. It's also what makes us more respectable. It's also what makes us more adaptable. Because the person who knows and loves their own weakness doesn't hate weakness when they see it in other people. And Jesus is not willing to buy into this temptation, because we have seen what happens when power and religion go together. The singular use of power for the supposed aims of the gospel. The supposed aims of the gospel. We're going to make a Christian civilization, everybody. It just don't work. The Christian civilization starts with your personal conversion. You can't make anybody else do it. This is what your experience from your family should teach you. You could teach them everything you can about the faith. You can be the best witness to the gospel from beginning to end. You could have done everything right, and your kid can walk right out the door. As a priest, I could theoretically, but I haven't. I've got a pretty good track record of failure, and I've only been in this parish since July. It's pretty awesome. I could do everything right and still have the entire church walk out and say, we hate that guy. So be it. The temptation for popularity, the temptation for power, often corrupts the most sensible of people into doing things they know are wrong for some kind of perverted end. And they will always justify it by saying, the greater good. But we in the church know that a good can never come out of something that isn't of itself intrinsically evil. The murdering of the innocent. The stealing from the poor. From casting out those who deserve a friend. You can't build a communion of love on those things. The last one, jump from the cliff. This one doesn't sound all that tempting. It's like, go onto the top and hey, jump. And I can just imagine a moment just in mere literary prose, just being able to, that is just the stupidest temptation I could ever possibly imagine. Why are you telling me to do that? But it's more subtle than that. In fact, what the devil is quoting is the psalm you so beautifully sung earlier on this evening. Psalm 91, he will give his angels charge over you and they will protect you. In other words, go ahead, do something stupid. God will protect you. I have seen so many young people lose chastity, virtue, strength, wisdom, because they thought, I can go anywhere and do anything because God loves me. And indeed he does. Indeed he does. But he invented something called free will. And if we don't want his protection, if we don't want his love, then jumping off a cliff is about as stupid as jumping off a cliff. And the temptation is to treat God like my personal property, as if God is my service monkey that does whatever I say, when I say, how I say it, which is a total destruction not only of who Jesus is as the Son, but it's also even more egregiously a contrary to who we are as his creation, as his sons and daughters. We all know from personal experience that the kid that just presumes that they're perfect because mommy and daddy like me, that's just terrifying. We've all met at least one. And it's even worse when we are children of God and then we presume that because God loves me, I can do whatever I want to other people. Again, one does not have to go too many centuries back into history to find many people that have done this. We must be aware that what makes a Christian truly exist as a Christian is their discipleship of God. We don't tell him what to do. We're starving, hungry, alone, tempted, fearful. But God hasn't abandoned us. And that's what we're practicing in this Lenten season. It's merely practice. It's practice for when it really happens in your life. You may be denying yourself certain foods right now. You may be denying yourself certain creature comforts or pleasures or who knows what. But what happens when you're 90 years old and those things are taken from you without your consent? It's a lot better to know in advance that those things don't matter. It's a lot better to know in advance that state sponsorship won't make the church better. It is better to know in advance that perfect world harmony and peace is not a sign that God is reigning in this world. We have to know that sometimes feeling good and warmed and lovey by God does not necessarily mean that we're walking along the narrow path. We start with the truth that he has loved us, that the Word has become flesh, that he makes his dwelling among us, which means that no matter how deep I might get into the stuff, just add a different S word right there. No matter how deep I get into the stuff, he is unafraid of entering into it. But I must let him come in. I must open the door. For he made me free. And for freedom, Christ has set us free.